majestic, colorful spinning sphere looms far in the distance above me, casting its bright shadow over the darkness. Jupiter. Even at hundreds of miles away, the gas giant dominates the sky. It's a few moments before I can tear my eyes away and take in the rest of my surroundings. I am hovering on the edge of one of the Pontus's outer modules, my feet skimming a platform between the side of the ship and the glowing wing of a solar panel. When I glance down, it appears my clothing has transformed from the ISTC uniform to a heavyweight spacesuit, with a thick tether cord running from my suit's harness to a handlebar on the module. I spot a flicker of movement across from me, and then Beckett appears, crouching on the opposite solar panel. A crackling sound comes over my headset. Houston is reporting a damaged solar array interfering with our power supply. General Sokoloff's voice echoes over the radio. Leo and Beckett, we need you to find and cut the snagged wire and install the stabilizers. You'll find the tools in your equipment belts, with step-by-step instructions downloaded to your wrist monitors. Do you copy?
Copy,
Beckett answers, and I'm quick to echo him. But inside my suit, I'm sweating at the realization that I have no idea what I'm doing, and he is the last teammate I'd ever choose to depend on for help. Naomi, with your computer skills, we've put you on the robotic canadarm, positioned in front of our external multiplexer demultiplexer. Please run diagnostics on the computer and confirm all systems a go for approach to Europa. Copy that. Naomi's voice crinkles over the radio, and I glance up, my eyes widening at the sight of her balancing on the edge of a moving crane swinging above the Pontus.
Approaching the first solar array, Beckett says,
and I refocus on the golden panel in front of me, crossing toward it in the short, bouncy steps my tether allows as I fight against the change in gravity. I am first to spot the torn layer of solar cells, and I reach into the tool belt attached to my suit, pulling out a long wire that matches the image blinking on my wrist monitor screen. And then I feel something smack against my shoulder. Beckett has caught up to me, the force of his motion knocking the tool out of my hands. The wire spins, floating away from me into the vacuum of space. I curse under my breath as Beckett sidles up to the torn array, ready to make this task his triumph alone. General Sokoloff, I'm getting warning signals from the external computer. They're coming through in Morse code and binary. Naomi's voice returns, muffled by a piercing, arrhythmic beeping in the background. The message is, incoming meteorites at direction 9 o'clock. But before she can even finish her sentence, the stillness of space is broken by a flood of shards as meteorites come flying through the air toward us. I scramble backward, away from the solar panel and toward the module, but I'm too late. The rocks slice at my tether, and I shout into the void as my body is flung adrift from the Pontus. My tether's gone! I yell into the radio, before remembering the general's instructions from the VR lab. Use the jetpacks. I press down on my joystick, pointing myself back in the direction of the spacecraft and triggering the thrust. But I didn't realize how powerful the jetpack's force would be. It knocks the breath from my lungs. I weave and duck past the flying shrapnel, but I can't get the hang of the pressure controls. Each push of my trigger blasts me too far, and now I'm spiraling through the air like an orbiter, moving too fast to feel my own limbs. Leo, slow down! I hear Naomi shout through my headset. You have to ignite a shorter thrust and redirect your position to 3 o'clock. She breaks off with a scream, and I look around wildly, following her directions and maneuvering the thrusters with shaky hands, until I finally see the canadarm through the shower of meteorites, cracked in two from the blast. Naomi dangles off the edge, reaching toward one of the handlebars on the Pontus module as the crane starts to whip around like a spinning top, but her gloves only grasp at air.
Beckett, a little help, please,
I snap through my headset, before radioing the general again.
Naomi and I are both detached from the spacecraft.
I'm using my propellers to launch toward her. But Sokoloff remains unresponsive, and I think I know why.
I'm caught under the battery module,
Beckett groans, and I turn to see a figure in the distance hanging upside down from the spacecraft, his foot stuck in wire netting, while his hand fumbles for his tool belt.
Hang on, Naomi calls out. Looks like I can operate the Canadarm through my wrist monitor. Even with the arm broken, if I can just direct this piece of the crane to swing in the right direction, I can grab you both, and we can make a jump for the airlock. Leo, can you close the distance with your jetpack? Aim for 6 o'clock.
On it, I yell back, determination setting in as I push down on my joystick. This time it better work. I lunge forward through the void, using every spare ounce of my strength and coordination to direct my hurtling body toward the spinning robotic arm as it shifts direction, flailing toward the pontus.
Naomi reaches out,
and my glove grasps hers.
Almost there, she says with a smile,
and for a moment, I'm mesmerized by her composure under pressure. But then the crane swings again, and I clamber on top of it in the nick of time,
Naomi grabbing hold of my waist,
as the Canadarm whirls closer and closer to the pontus.
We're about to drop down to the battery module, Beckett, Naomi shouts. Get your tether ready for us, and we'll cut you loose and make it to the airlock together.
But Beckett is one step ahead of us. As we circle closer to the module, I can see he's managed to unearth a steel cutter from his tool belt with his free hand, and is slicing through the netting. Once extricated, he starts pulling his way across the spacecraft from handle to handle, heading for the airlock without us.
Beckett, she said to wait, I yell through the radio. This way makes more sense, he argues. I can get to the airlock faster and prep it for opening so we don't waste time there.
Naomi and I exchange a glance.
We know what he's really up to. Angling to be first, to win the challenge. If we don't jump now, we'll miss it, she says, gripping my glove in hers. Engage the thrusters one last time. I can feel my heart clanging as we let go of the crane, our two bodies propelling through open space with a gust of fuel. My free hand claws in front of me for one of the handles or knobs to break our fall, and then smack. My glove grips something solid, my feet scratch against metal, and that's a wrap. Welcome back to Earth.
A voice cuts through the scene. I shake my head to rid myself of the sound, still trying to get to the airlock,
until it disappears from view. Someone lifts the mask from my eyes, but I'm not fully in the real world yet.
My hand is still in Naomi's, my feet kicking the legs of my chair as I try to make our way to safety.
When I finally open my eyes, the sight of the room and its equipment is a relief, and yet somehow seems all wrong.
Naomi and I drop each other's hands,
and I notice a flush creeping up her cheeks.
That felt so real.
I blink up at General Sokolov standing before us. I almost forgot it was just a sim. She nods approvingly.
That's the idea. Our technology works with your consciousness to make the simulation as immersive and authentic as possible.
But why did it stop before we got to the airlock? Beckett asks with a frown. I was so close.
Yeah, you were. I shoot him a glare. Traitor.
I saw what I needed to see, the general says, a cryptic expression on her face. Now all three of you did well and displayed strong instincts, but one of you in particular stood out. Sib, I take it we're on the same page?
I hold my breath as the robot unplugs from the VR grid and wires, turning to face us. For the ability to read and decipher machine code, the understanding of velocity and propulsion mechanisms, and ability to think on her feet. The winner of this round is the American,
Naomi Ardalan.
I watch as Beckett's face turns to stone,
and Naomi's flush deepens.
And to my surprise, as much as I wanted to win, hearing her name feels almost as good. That night in the cafeteria, something is different. The buffet counters are dark, with none of the usual savory smells wafting through the room. What do you think is going on? I ask Asher as we head to our table.
No idea, but let's hope nothing's wrong.
I've been dreaming about this meal all day. He rubs his stomach hopefully. We slide into our seats as Dr. Takumi enters the room, stepping up to the raised faculty platform, looming above us all with his rod-like posture and fixed gaze.
From now on, dinner will be pushed back half an hour. However, you are all still required to meet here at the usual time, so we can incorporate something vital into our schedule. It has to do with the RRB.
His voice takes on an almost reverent tone as he says the name.
Radiation-resistant bacteria is the foremost reason the 24 of you are sitting here. Not only does the advent of the RRB make it possible for us to finally explore Jupiter orbit without risking deadly radiation exposure, but the vaccine's age limit caused us to seek out a new pool of astronauts. And find you.
His eyes rove over the crowd, and my senses heighten as his glance lands on me.
Those of you who make the final six will be required to self-administer daily injections of the RRB as soon as you enter the solar system's radiation belt, Dr. Takumi continues. Not only will the RRB protect you during spaceflight, but it shields your body from Europa's extremely hazardous rays, so missing a single dose could be catastrophic. That's why we must use this time, the last days on Earth for six of you, to gauge your reactions to the experimental serum. If any of your bodies are going to react adversely, now is the time to find out.
He clears his throat.
That said, each of you will receive nightly preemptive shots of the RRB starting now. We've set up a small outpost for the NASA medical officer here on the HAB floor just down the hall. That's where you'll line up every night before dinner to get your shots. Team leaders, please escort your finalists there now.
Well, this is interesting, Asher says as we rise to our feet. He looks almost as uneasy as I feel. It never even occurred to me that some of us might not be able to tolerate the RRB. Please don't let me be one of them.
We follow Lark and the rest of our fellow finalists out of the cafeteria and down a carpeted corridor until we reach a pocket-sized, sterile white room. A petite woman in a lab coat stands by the door, clipboard in hand. All right, who's ready to go first? She calls out in greeting.
No one answers. Not even the most competitive among us. Instead, most of the 24 jostle for a spot at the end of the line. It seems I'm not the only one here who's creeped out by needles. Still, it occurs to me now that volunteering to go first could be a mark in my favor. And I'll take any slight edge I can get. I raise my hand, and the medic beckons me through the open door. She motions for me to have a seat before slipping on a pair of latex gloves and filtering a glowing blue liquid into a hypodermic needle. As she preps my arm for the puncture, I look out at the crowd of finalists, watching us warily as they wait their turn.
My eyes meet Naomi's.
It might be that I feel closer to her because of what we experienced together in today's training sim, or because she's the only person here who knows my sister's name. Either way, finding her face in the crowd is like a breath of relief. She smiles at me, and as the nurse plunges the needle into my arm, I hardly feel the sting. But then Naomi's gaze shifts, something pulling her attention behind me. It's the row of blue vials lining the office wall. I can almost see her mind at work as she studies them, her eyes narrowing, and my curiosity stirs. What does she know that the rest of us don't?
10. Naomi. The scream slices the air of our dorm room. I wake with a jolt as my roommate lets out a second ear-splitting shriek, thrashing and kicking against her mattress. My fingers shake as I fumble for the light switch. Suki, wake up! But she won't stir. I jump out of my bed and run to hers. Suki's face is pale and glassy, her forehead slicked with sweat. I'm startled to find her eyes open, with only the whites showing, and I shrink back, suddenly afraid of what I don't know. No, don't go, she wails, tears streaking down her cheeks. I can't let her continue like this. I reach for her arm, but she automatically slaps my hand away. She must be fighting something in her dream, and right now I am the stand-in. I'm bound to get hit again if I stay this close, but I have no choice. Her screams are agonizing, like sharp fingernails scratching at a bloody scab, and I use all my strength to shake her back into consciousness. Wake up! I shout in her ear, gripping her shoulders. Suki, wake up! It does the trick. She blinks, dazed and panting as she takes in her surroundings. And then, meeting my eyes, she starts to cry. The kind of unrestrained, racking sobs I never would have expected from someone as calm and collected as Suki. It's okay, I whisper, placing my hand over hers. You're okay. It was just a dream. She shakes her head violently. It wasn't, she chokes out through her tears. It was the same nightmare I'm forced to remember every day. Only I've never dreamed it like that, so vivid and full of every horrific detail. She breaks off, crying too hard to speak. What do you mean? I ask, fearing her response. What if I'm the wrong person to help her? I don't know what to do. I watched my mom and siblings die. I saw the whole thing, and I couldn't stop it. My hand flies to my mouth. One minute I was in the kitchen cleaning my drunk of a stepfather's mess, watching my mom and brother and sister play bocce ball through the window, and the next... Fresh tears spill from her eyes. You wouldn't believe what I was thinking then. I was worried about what would happen when I went back to school, when I'd have to leave the three of them at his mercy. I was so distracted worrying about a future they would never have, that I missed my split-second chance to save them. I heard the sound of the roar, and I wasn't quick enough to recognize it as a warning. I squeeze her hand, my heart in my throat as she speaks. I wonder if I should interrupt and tell her she doesn't have to say anymore, not if it's too painful to remember. But something in her voice lets me know that she needs this, and I stay silent. The wave looked like a 100-foot cobra, arched and ready to strike. Suki's voice drops to a whisper. By the time I saw it, it was too late. The tsunami had already seized my family and everyone else on the beachfront, sweeping them all out to sea. The water came pouring in, crushing the front door and chasing my stepfather upstairs, but I let it carry me outside. I swam against the current, searching for my family, but there was no hope. All I saw were piles of bodies and upturned boats slicing the faces of the drowned. I've tried to wipe that image from my mind, but I can't. I'm sorry. I'm so sorry. I throw my arms around her, realizing that I am crying too. My stomach churns and my chest aches as I imagine what she went through. Her words trigger my memories of seeing the tsunami all over the news, the horror my family and I felt at the photos of the carnage. But by the next day, there was a new disaster to report, and the world quickly moved on from mourning Singapore. You become numb to the daily tragedies until the next one happens to you. As I look at Suki and think of Leo and Gian, I can't help seeing the Europa mission in a different light. If it worked, what an escape it would be. But I am too scientific for blind faith. I wish I could believe in the mission. I wish I could forget what my hypothesis and my gut are telling me about Jupiter's moon. But I can't. Where did you go after? I ask, wiping my eyes. What did you do? Suki shakes her head bitterly. I didn't have a choice. I had to stay with the drunk because I was still a minor and had no money of my own. I thought it would be just a few more months stuck with him in that house, and then I'd go back to university and be gone for good. Her eyes drop. But I soon found out the university went under, too. So this is the first time you've left since... My voice trails off and she nods. Yes. And now that I've gotten away, I'm never going back. I'm going to make the final six, or I'll die trying. I understand, I murmur, wrapping my arm around her. She leans her limp head on my shoulder, exhausted from the conversation. But her forehead is burning, and I sit up in alarm. Suki, are you feeling sick? She shrugs slightly, and I press my palm to her forehead. You're burning up. I should call the medic. I just need sleep. Suki bats my hand away and sinks under the covers. Don't call anyone, okay? Okay, I sigh. I'm going to get you a cold compress, though. I throw on a sweatshirt over my PJs, and I'm almost out the door when Suki sleepily calls my name. Thank you for being a friend, even though I haven't exactly been the warmest. She takes a breath. I guess I was afraid to get close to anyone I'm competing against. I turn around, my insides constricting at her tear-stained face. It's okay. I understand, and you can count on me. Morning dawns, and Suki is still pale and feverish, with a fiery red rash running down her arm. I bite my nails with worry as I stare at her. This looks serious, Suki. Please, just let me take you to the medical office. No, I can't let the judges find out and decide I'm too weak for the draft, she argues, especially now that we only have a couple weeks to prove ourselves before the first eliminations. I just have to get through today without it being obvious there's anything wrong with me, and then hopefully this flu will go away. So she hasn't suspected that it's more than just the flu. Either that or she's in denial. I wonder if I should tell her my opinion, if maybe that will convince her to see the nurse, but I keep my mouth shut, afraid to stress her further. Instead, I help Suki apply concealer to her puffy eyes and lend her a long-sleeved tee to wear under her ISTC shirt before giving her my arm to lean on as we walk to the cafeteria. She stumbles on our way down the hall, and I stop to steady her. Are you feeling dizzy? I ask. She hesitates before nodding. Suki, please let me... No way, she cuts me off. You know why I can't risk getting cut. I can't go home. I rub my face with my hands, torn. Okay, fine. Just stay close to me all day. She squeezes my arm. Thank you. I link my arm with hers as we step into the cafeteria, and when it's time to hit the buffet line, I order for her, grabbing every high-protein item on offer. Back at the table, our teammates are busy quizzing Lark about her astronaut years, and I think Suki and I are doing a reasonably good job of pulling off our act, until Leo leans in across from me. What's wrong with her? He whispers. I glance around me. Leo and I are at the far end of the table, and the others are still absorbed in their conversation, paying little attention to us. I could tell him without them overhearing, and it would be a relief, but am I certain I can trust him? I turn to Suki, who's now dragging her spoon through a bowl of oatmeal as if it requires colossal effort. She's right beside me, and at the same time she seems to be somewhere else. Naomi, Leo looks at me knowingly. I know something's up. You don't have to tell me, but just let me know if I can help. I close my eyes. God, I would love some help. I lean across the table until our faces are so close I can feel his breath against my cheek. And I whisper, I think she's having a reaction to the RRB, but you can't tell anyone. I pull back in time to see the alarm register on Leo's face. But if she's sick, shouldn't we get her some help? Believe me, I said the same thing, but for now at least we have to do as she asked and not say a word. I don't want to be the one to blow her chances of making the final six. It hits me how ironic my words are. If my brother were here, he would tell me I'd be doing Suki a favor by risking her spot in the draft and keeping her here on Earth. But now, knowing what she's been through, what so many of my fellow finalists have suffered on our planet, I feel my conviction starting to waver. Today's first training period takes us to the third floor altitude chamber, a cavernous space made almost entirely out of ice. It looks like an empty indoor igloo, with nothing but scattered orange cones and piled blocks of ice filling the space. Lark passes out thick puffer jackets before dropping us off, and I feel a sprig of hope that maybe this cold is just what Suki needs. Maybe it can break her fever. What's up with her? Beckett asks loudly, watching as Suki holds onto my arm, leaning most of her body weight against me. I feel my shoulders stiffen in defense. She didn't sleep well last night, that's all. Lieutenant Barnes, our instructor from the diving tank, is waiting for us inside, this time dressed in snow weather gear. And he's not alone. Dot is with him, the robot's artificial eyes roving over each one of us. Welcome to the altitude chamber, the lieutenant greets us with a sweep of his hands. The space we're standing in is a NASA-engineered replica of Terra Macula, the ice surface terrain where the final six will land when they reach Europa. A ripple of excitement runs through my teammates. Katerina does a little spin on the ice, managing to make it look elegant even in tennis shoes. It feels like home, I hear her murmur to Asher, before Lieutenant Barnes continues. In preparing for any mission, astronauts in training will generally spend 2 hours a day exercising, 3 times a week, to prepare their bodies for the physical changes that occur in space. We often put them through military-grade obstacle courses, in addition to the standard gym routines. At the same time, our scientists develop altitude chambers like this one to help astronauts' bodies adjust to the environment they'll be entering. However, in your case, with so much training we need to pack into so little time, we've decided to kill 2 birds with 1 stone by combining the physical challenge of a military obstacle course with the Europa altitude chamber. I exchange a nervous glance with Suki. Could there be worse timing for a training session like this? Europa has no atmosphere, which means no wind or weather, so you'll be safe from all the climate-related crises that plague us on Earth. Lieutenant Barnes pauses, smiling at my teammates' reaction to that. There are only two environmental issues on Europa that we're aware of. The first is the occurrence of ice quakes, which should feel similar to a low-grade earthquake. The second are known as water eruptions, when shifting tectonic plates cause enormous plumes of water to shoot out of the ice. While these events might sound unsettling, both are fairly mild compared to what we've been through here on Earth. I eye the lieutenant suspiciously. How can he say that with any authority when he's never experienced either of those things for himself? Besides, even if these are the only environmental issues they're aware of, how soon will it be before the hands of humans wreak havoc on this new world, just as we did on Earth? I'm beginning to wonder who should be more afraid. Us of Europa's unknowns and its potential intelligent life, or them of humans and our tendency to destroy. To complete the course, you'll run sprints around the path of orange cones and jump over the ice block hurdles, dodging any simulated ice quakes or water plume eruptions that may occur. Lieutenant Barnes instructs us. Your challenge is to make it through the obstacles without falling and without touching the water or the cones. You'll complete the course in pairs, and whoever has the fastest time and fewest deductions at the end wins. Got it? I cringe. This is an athletic feat beyond my comfort zone, and way beyond what Suki is capable of right now. She turns to me in panic. I can't mess up, she gasps. I need to win. I resist the urge to tell her that's not about to happen in her state. Let's be partners, I suggest instead. I'll go at your speed so you don't seem off compared to the others. Thank you, she says, her face flooding with relief. I can't thank you enough. No problem, I tell her, though a small voice in my mind reminds me of Dr. Takumi's warning. What if I'm not a good enough actress to pull this off? What if they figure out that I'm throwing the game on purpose? Then again, my paltry athletic skills could come in handy here. It won't take that much effort to make Suki look decent. All right, line up in pairs. Leo and Asher stand at the head of the line, with Katerina and Beckett right behind them, and me and Suki going last. I watch, nerves mounting, as Leo and Asher take off the second Lieutenant Barnes blows the whistle. The two of them weave around the cones at a breakneck speed, occasionally slipping on the ice but catching themselves before they touch the ground. And then the first ice quake hits. I'm not even in the obstacle course, and my body sways, hands gripping my knees to keep from falling over and dragging Suki down with me. Asher hits the ground, but Leo keeps running, leaping over one of the ice blocks with such confidence that I can't look away. Asher gets to his feet, and I hear Katerina cheering him on as he catches up, running to the hurdles. Just as Leo soars over the second-to-last hurdle, a 4-foot-high gust of water bursts from the floor. I gasp, but he doesn't stop moving, his face a mask of determination. Another blast of water hits right before his final jump, and in one of the most stunning sights I've ever seen, Leo takes a flying leap, soaring above the water plume and hitting the finish line. Wow, I whisper. Asher finishes not far behind, and then the whistle blows for Katerina and Beckett. Knowing we're next has me too jittery to watch, and instead I attempt to give Suki a pep talk. Once we get out there, for these next few minutes, just try to block out whatever you're feeling, okay? Pretend you're as good as on your healthiest day and just go kick ass. She nods, but her eyes are distant, her face sweaty even in this cold. My heart sinks. And next! That's us, I say with a gulp. Let's get in position. Suki and I assume the runner stance at the starting line, my muscles tensing in anticipation. When the whistle blows, I hang back a split second to let her go first, and then I follow. Running on ice is harder than it looks, and when the ground below me rattles from the first ice quake, I fall smack on my butt. Hoisting myself back up, I spot Suki making a valiant effort, her hands gripping her shins to keep from falling in the quake. I resist the urge to cheer her on, and I keep running until the water plume hits. My feet slide out from under me, and I tumble back down onto the ice. Come on, ladies, Beckett shouts from the sidelines. Way to represent America, Naomi. I grit my teeth. That obnoxious son of a sickening crash sounds, echoing through the chamber like shattered glass. My heart nearly stops at the sight of Suki crumpled at the side of the ice block, having failed to clear the hurdle. I scramble upright and run at full speed for the first time today until I reach her. Her face is contorted in pain. Are you okay? I'm so sorry. I should never have let you... Lieutenant Barnes swoops down, interrupting my babbling. Let's take a look at that ankle, he says as Suki manages to sit up. I'm okay, she wheezes. It's just a light sprain. I'm fine, really. I close my eyes briefly. Is she seriously going to refuse help again? I feel a gentle pressure on my shoulder, and I turn around. It's Leo, his blue eyes full of concern. The rest of our teammates crowd around Lieutenant Barnes and Suki, but Leo is here for me. I step off to the side so we can talk alone. I don't know what to do, I tell him under my breath. I told her I'd help her, but something is clearly wrong. He finishes my sentence. And not just because she missed the jump. That could happen to anyone. It's the way she is today. I know just what he means. Our poised, laser-focused teammate is like a different person ever since last night, since the RRB. I turn to look back at Suki, who is hobbling to her feet with the help of Lieutenant Barnes. She's done, someone says behind me, and I whip around to find Beckett, watching the scene with a patronizing look on his face. Her head's clearly not in the game. Will you just shut up? Leo snaps at him, and I feel a rush of gratitude. Beckett raises his eyebrows at Leo. I would have thought you would be glad for a little less competition. Then you weren't paying attention, because I just beat your time out there, Leo shoots back. If anyone needs lighter competition, it's not me. You only beat me by 2 seconds, Beckett scoffs. I'd call it more of a coin toss. Besides, you've already shown all you've got. I'm just getting warmed up. Right, that's what all second-place finishers say. As much as I love watching Leo take the jerk down, I don't want to leave Suki alone with the others for much longer. I grab his arm. Let's go find out how she's doing. We turn our backs on Beckett and return to Suki, who forces a smile when she sees us. Sorry about all that. I was just telling Lieutenant Barnes that my ankle really doesn't hurt badly enough to bother with the medic. I'll try to rest it today, and I'm sure I'll be better by tomorrow. I appreciate the spirit, Lieutenant Barnes says with a nod. That's what we like to see here at ISTC. I'll tell Lark to keep you off your feet today, but I'll expect you back in fighting form tomorrow. Absolutely. Suki beams, and I have to admire her performance. Maybe that fall knocked the zombie-like symptoms out of her. She certainly seems more alert and eager now. Or maybe that's just how desperate she is to stay. The need trumps everything, even agonizing pain. Back to work, Lieutenant Barnes calls out, gathering everyone toward him. I have the final scores based on your times. Coming in last with an incomplete is Suki, preceded by Naomi in fifth, also with an incomplete. The two of us exchange a miserable glance, even though the results aren't exactly a surprise. I hear Beckett stifle a snort, and I have a sudden urge to kick something. In fourth place, with a time of 4 minutes and 30 seconds, is Asher. Katerina takes third with 4 minutes even. The question is, why am I so frustrated? I wanted Suki to do well, not me. I've already gotten more attention here than I intended, considering my ultimate goal is to go home. But the defeat leaves a sour taste in my mouth. Is it possible? Am I actually getting swept up in the competition of it all? And in second place, we have Beckett with a time of 3 minutes, 40 seconds. That makes Leo our winner, coming in at just 3 minutes, 38 seconds. Everyone applauds, except Beckett, of course. Leo smiles broadly. I smile back. Suki seems to inch closer to normal as the day wears on, still a little too pale and sweating even under the blast of the AC, but I can see the life coming back into her eyes. Still, when 6:30 rolls around and it's time to line up for our second shot of the RRB, I urge her yet again to tell the nurse about her symptoms. I mean, doesn't it seem a little unwise to get another dose without telling them how you've been feeling since last night? Suki remains stubborn as ever. I told you, I have to make the final six. I can't go back, and if I give them any reason to think I'm not as strong as the others here, then it's over for me. And so I watch, holding my breath as she gets another dose of the serum. Leo gives me a questioning look, but he doesn't say anything either, both of us guarding her secret, for better or worse. We proceed from the medical office to the cafeteria for dinner, and it's as odd a segue as you can imagine, going from injections to the British menu of bangers and mash. Once we're seated in front of full plates, Dr. Takumi makes a surprise announcement, the kind I've been waiting for since the moment I arrived. After the meal, team leaders will escort you to the library for your first weekly video chat with your families. All of your next of kin have been notified and will be waiting by their computers at the designated time. The whoops and cheers from all four cafeteria tables nearly drown him out. The thought of finally getting to see and speak to Sam and my parents has me giddy, too overcome to eat another bite. Katerina and Asher beam as they launch into an animated conversation about who from their hometowns they expect to see in their video chats, while Beckett joins in half-heartedly. I'm amazed he's not taking the opportunity to gloat about webcamming with the White House, and I'm about to whisper as much to Leo when I notice his crushed expression. Suki pushes her full plate away, her eyes trained on the floor, and my heart twists for them both. There can't be anything worse than knowing that the only people who matter won't be there on the other side of the screen. I don't have to go, do I? Leo asks Lark under his breath. You want to stand up your date? Lark raises an eyebrow at him, and Leo stares at her in confusion. I don't have a next of kin, he says, so I figured... That you wouldn't have a video chat? Not a chance, Lark says with a grin. We received a very impassioned letter from a certain Elena Vincenti asking for communication privileges with you. I couldn't say no to a letter like that. She lowers her voice to a conspiratorial tone. And her being the Prime Minister's daughter certainly helped me get a yes from Dr. Takumi. My face turns strangely hot as I listen, though I don't know why I care. So what if he has a girlfriend back home? The PM's daughter? Beckett cocks an eyebrow. You're a dark horse. It's not like... Leo starts, his cheeks reddening, but Asher interrupts. Own it, man! He fist bumps Leo, and I feel my insides go twitchy with irritation. And for the first time since we met, the sight of Leo's smile makes me feel worse instead of better. By the time we make it to the library for our turn at the computers, I'm practically bursting out of my skin. I can't stop fidgeting as Lark sets up the video chat monitors and logs each of us in. I wait impatiently for her to finish getting Katerina set up before coming around to my seat. Finally, I'm logged in, my eager face staring back at me from the left-hand corner of the screen. And then... Naomi! Azizam! Sam and my parents' faces fill the screen, and as I gaze at them, it's like taking my first real breath after days underwater. My eyes fill with tears as I forget everyone else in this room, forget everything but them. It's so good to see you, I manage to choke out. I miss you so much. Not as much as we miss you, Mom says, placing her hand up to the screen. How are you, sweetie? Dad asks, and I notice he's wearing the fuzzy green sweater I got him for Father's Day. I'd give anything to be able to reach through the computer and hug him. I'm okay. I can't stand being away from you guys. It's just as hard as I thought it would be. But luckily I made a couple of friends here, and that helps a little. Of course you did, Sam says with a wistful smile. That reminds me, we have something to show you, Dad says, his voice rising in excitement. I hear him fumbling off screen, and then he holds up a copy of Time magazine. Incredible, right? I suck in my breath. It's us, the 24, on the cover of the magazine, under a bold headline that reads, The Teenagers Saving the Human Race. Wow, I murmur. It's surreal to see me and my teammates on the cover of a magazine, but more than pride, the sight fills me with fear. Fear that we're leading on the public, lifting their hopes too high when there's no guarantee our story won't end differently from the Athena disaster, or that Europa won't turn out to be every bit as perilous as Earth. They devoted the most space to you and Beckett Wolf, Sam adds, taking the magazine from Dad and flipping through the pages until he finds what he's looking for. He holds an article up to the screen, a feature titled, The First Nephew in the Iranian-American Prodigy, with a glossy photo of me and Beckett standing stiffly next to each other on arrival day. Knowing how President Wolf feels about immigrants, he must love all the attention on our heritage, Dad laughs. That's true, I say with a smile. Beckett is probably just as thrilled to have to share all his press with me. I know it's petty, but I can't help feeling a flicker of satisfaction at the annoyance this headline will cause him. Enough about me, though. I've been dying to know how you guys are doing. I peer closer at the three of them. Sam, how are you feeling? I'm okay. Going to all my appointments and taking my meds. You don't need to worry, sis, he says with a wry grin. But as I study him through the screen, I feel a wave of anxiety. He looks even thinner than when I left, and there's no hiding the weariness in his eyes. Are you resting enough? Eating enough? I thought families of the 24 were supposed to get extra food. Yes to all three, Sam says, chuckling. I'm fine, but I can see Space Camp hasn't changed you a bit. I try to smile, to shake the feeling that his reassurance is just a put-on for my benefit. We're taking great care of him, sweetie. Don't worry, Mom says, wrapping her arm around Sam. I feel a pang in my chest at the sight of them, so close while I'm an impenetrable distance away. What's it like over there? Are you enjoying yourself at all? Dad asks, looking at me hopefully. Actually, yeah, sometimes. The training we've done so far is pretty incredible. It's like we're in Hogwarts for space, but instead of teaching us magic, they're preparing us to get kicked off the planet. I laugh. I'll have a ton of stories for you when I come home. In the silence that falls, I can almost hear them all tweaking my sentence in their minds. If you come home. So, did you open my letter? Sam asks, trying to sound casual. I know the real question he's asking. Do I plan to use the flash drive with the hacking software, and am I making progress on my true mission, to return to them, to stay on Earth? I have to assure him that I'm keeping my promise to come home, without giving myself away if Lark or anyone else overhears. I did, and in answer to your question, I'm still figuring it out, I reply, but I will. My parents are clearly confused, but before they can ask what we're talking about, Lark signals for our attention. Time to log off. It's the next team's turn at the computers. My stomach plummets. We can't be done so soon. And I can't fathom the thought of only ever seeing my family like this, in painfully short bursts through a computer monitor. I love you guys, I say, swallowing the lump in my throat. I don't want to say goodbye. We love you more, Azizam, Dad says gruffly, and I can tell he's getting choked up. Mom's eyes are watery as she blows kisses through the screen, and Sam gives me the goofy secret hand signal we made up in elementary school. I thought he'd forgotten it, and I laugh through my tears. Love you, sis. I really miss you. And then the screen turns black, its emptiness leaving me with renewed resolve. I have to set a plan in motion.
11. Leo. There's a banging at my door, a shouting that pierces through my dreams. I wake with a start, blinking at the clock beside me as it flashes 3:30. Did I imagine the noise? What could be going on at this hour? But then I hear a familiar voice cry out for help, and I throw the covers off me. I step into the first pair of pants I can find and open the door. It's Naomi. As soon as she sees me, her face crumples. Suki's in trouble. She gasps. Everything was fine. I thought she was getting better, and then... Asher joins us in the doorway, rubbing his eyes. What's going on? Something's happened to Suki, I tell him. Let's go. The three of us run down the dark corridor to the girls' wing. A few bleary-eyed finalists peeking their heads out of their rooms at the sound of the commotion, until we're standing at the door to Naomi and Suki's room. I can hear a strangled sound coming from inside. And Naomi hesitates before opening the door.
I should prepare you. It's really bad.
It's okay, Asher tells her. I was in the military, and Leo... His voice trails off, but I know where his sentence leads. Leo's whole family died. He can handle a sick teammate. Come on, I tell Naomi. She gulps and opens the door, and my whole body tenses in panic. A wild animal is convulsing on the bed, shaking and foaming at the mouth. Her head snaps in our direction as we enter, and she opens her mouth to speak, to yell, but all that comes out are garbled sounds. The effort seems to agitate her more, and now she's rattling the bed frame with her shaking, her skin turning a bluish-gray hue. This isn't Suki. It can't be.
I've never seen anything like this.
Naomi stares at the bed in terror.
At first, I thought it was a seizure, but it's only getting worse. I wanted to take her to the medic, but I can't lift her by myself, and you're not supposed to move someone when they're having a seizure, if that's even what this is.
She breaks off, shaking her head helplessly, and I turn to Asher.
Go get help, okay? Try and make it back as fast as you can.
I sound far stronger than I feel, and Asher nods, looking relieved to have something to do. As he races out of the room, I take a few tentative steps towards Suki.
It's going to be okay,
I stammer, though I know she's not listening. She's too far gone. Hope is coming, and... In the space of a breath, Suki reaches up and seizes both my wrists. Her force catches me off guard, and I shout out as she presses her fingernails into my skin.
What's she doing?
Naomi cries.
I don't know. How did she... Get so strong,
I choke out.
Tahaihoja.
Suki stares at me with frantic eyes and repeats the phrase in a distorted voice.
Tahaihoja.
It's Mandarin, Naomi pants.
Please tell me you understand Mandarin.
I shake my head.
Tahaihoja.
Suki says again, this time in a whisper. And then she drops my wrists, and her body turns limp.
No!
Naomi screams, running to her side. I drop my head in my hands, dreading the moment that I know is coming. I can't see another dead body, not another person.
She's breathing!
Naomi holds two fingers against her pulse, and relief floods through me. There's still a chance. Footsteps come pounding toward us, and the door flies open. As Asher returns with Lark and Dr. Takumi in tow, Suki's body jerks forward, her convulsing recurring more violently than before. She pounds her head against the wall as she thrashes, still crying out the unfamiliar phrase, Ta hai huo jia. I can see tears in her eyes, and I turn to Dr. Takumi and Lark in desperation.
What's happening to her? And what's she saying?
Naomi demands from behind me.
Can you understand her?
Lark's face drains of color as she takes in the scene. She turns to Dr. Takumi, who doesn't say a word either. He simply steps forward, his presence in the middle of the dorm room only adding to the heightened sense of fear. And he reaches for Suki. I hold my breath as he lifts her off the bed, and she shrieks, her head whipping back and forth, her hands clawing at the air. Still managing to maintain his composure, Dr. Takumi reaches into his jacket pocket and pulls out a syringe.
What are you do-
But before Naomi can get out her question, Dr. Takumi plunges the needle into Suki's skin,
and everything turns quiet.
This light sedative should do the trick, he says, tightening his grip around Suki.
He moves toward the door,
and Naomi jumps in front of him.
Where are you taking her? What's happening?
I'm afraid she's had an adverse reaction to the RRB, he says coolly. I'm taking her to the larger medical facility at Johnson Space Center. We'll keep you updated as necessary.
The four of us watch as Dr. Takumi carries her away, until all that's left of Suki is the stench of fear. Lark sighs heavily.
I'm sorry you all had to see that. When the body rejects a vaccine, it can on occasion cause catatonic symptoms that are frightening to witness. But you can trust that Dr. Takumi is getting Suki the best care possible.
If the RRB is so risky,
Naomi starts, but Lark cuts her off.
For the vast majority of you, it isn't. Suki is the only one of the 24 to exhibit any symptoms.
So far, my mind adds.
Could one of us be next?
I know it'll be hard to sleep after this, she acknowledges. But we have another busy day tomorrow, and you'll want to be well rested.
Wait.
Naomi looks at her in disbelief.
So no matter what happens to Suki, tomorrow is business as usual?
That's how it works in our field, Lark says.
At NASA, I trained with the crew of the Athena, and I saw some of my closest friends die. I was devastated, but I still had to show up to work. Our goals at NASA remained the same, to push the boundaries of space and find a new home for human life. That doesn't change when something bad happens.
She moves toward the door, and there's no reason to believe that anything irreparable happened tonight. If I know Dr. Takumi, he won't spare any expense to make sure Suki returns to her old self.
Let's hope,
Naomi murmurs under her breath.
On that note, Lark continues, I suggest we go back to our rooms and at least try to get some sleep.
You guys go ahead, I tell them. I'll be just a few more minutes.
Lark gives me a sideways look, but she doesn't try to stop me.
Just don't make it much longer.
Good night, Naomi.
I hope you'll be okay. Asher says, his eyes flicking back to Suki's empty bed, before following Lark out of the room. And then it's just the two of us.
I watch as Naomi crosses to her side of the room, decorated with photos and posters, where Suki's is bare. She sinks to the floor, leaning against her bed frame with her head pressed to her knees. This is all my fault, she says dully. I suspected something was wrong 24 hours ago. I shouldn't have listened to her.
I could have prevented this. You don't know that, I say, clearing a space next to her on the floor. Plus, it seemed like she was getting better. I thought she was over the worst of it when I saw her at dinner. How are you to know something like this would happen? I shouldn't have let her get another injection, she continues through gritted teeth. Maybe she was getting better. But the second shot is what did it. This isn't your fault. I rest my hand on her arm. You didn't create the RRB, and you didn't force her to take it. You tried to get her help, and she refused. As someone who knows a thing or two about guilt, I take a deep breath. You have to let it go. She is quiet for a moment. Yeah, I guess you're right. Her eyes roam back to Suki's empty bed. There's no way I'm going to sleep tonight. I can stay here with you for as long as you want. She smiles slightly. Thank you. I really don't want to be alone right now. I smile back, something stirring in my chest as I look at her. I need a distraction, Naomi sighs, leaning her head back against the bed. She glances at me out of the corner of her eye. You know where I always wanted to go, before the floods?
Where?
Italy, she says. I had this dream folder at home, where I'd store photos and articles of places I wanted to go, things I wanted to do. I pictured taking this victory trip with my brother one day when he was all better. The plan was to spend 3 weeks going between Venice, Florence, Rome, and the Amalfi Coast, seeing all the landmarks and tasting all the regional dishes along the way. Her smile fades. It would have been amazing.
I wish you could have seen it too, I say quietly. Maybe if things had been different, we would have met there instead.
Yeah.
She is silent for a moment, and then she asks,
Will you tell me about it, Rome?
A fist closes around my heart. It's been so long since I've let myself remember what it was really like, when the Colosseum and the Spanish Steps stood on dry land, when my family was alive. But the images are already rushing to my mind, and I hear myself start to speak. Maybe everyone thinks their city is the center of the world, but Rome really was. We had history right in our backyard. The Gladiator Stadium, Vatican City. We had Michelangelo, Fellini. But even with all the history, somehow it never felt old. The city was filled with loud, pulsing life. Everywhere you went, there were people of all ages in cafes and restaurants, out in the nightclubs, cheering in the streets for the football teams on game day. I love the noise.
Sounds awesome,
Naomi says, closing her eyes. I can tell her body is relaxing, her tight shoulders loosening, and I continue. Even though it was technically a big city, there was a closeness among the locals. My neighbors were all involved in each other's lives. If I went out with a girl once, Mrs. Conti next door would ask about her for weeks afterward. I laugh. My family's pensione hosted a regular Sunday lunch for the locals and hotel guests. We stuffed ourselves with 6 courses of food, and then my mother would sit at the piano, and everyone would sing the classic Italian songs, the songs we all knew by heart. Sometimes we'd be there for hours. Angelica had an amazing voice. The rest of us were just loud, but she could really sing. Naomi shifts a little closer to me as I feel some part of myself leaving this room, returning home, bringing my family back to life. I look down at the Danieli signet ring on my finger, tracing the cursive letter D with my thumb. It was paradise, and I guess I'm lucky I got to experience it before it was all gone.
It sounds like heaven.
Naomi rests her head on my shoulder. We stay like that for minutes or hours. Time seems to disappear, until the sound of her soft breathing lets me know she's managed to fall asleep. As gently as I can, I lift her into my arms and onto the bed. She stirs, but doesn't wake, and I pull the covers up around her. "Good night, Naomi," I whisper. I look at her one last time. Her expression is so peaceful as she sleeps, as though the trauma we witnessed with Suki never happened. I step out of the room, feeling my way through the dark back to the boys' dorm. All the while, her face remains imprinted in my mind. I wake up a zombie the next morning, half delirious from barely any sleep. Asher and I get ready in a hurry, both of us anxious to see if, by some miracle, Suki will be waiting for us at our team table for breakfast. But when we walk into the cafeteria, we find her seat empty. Lark and Dr. Takumi are missing too. "I guess she's still getting treatment," I tell Asher. "God, I hope she's okay." I lock eyes with Naomi across the room, and I am suddenly wide awake. Asher and I slide into our seats, with me beside her. "Hey," I say, giving her a small smile. "How are you doing?"
"Hi, I'm..." She shakes her head. "I don't know. I just want to find out what happened to my roommate."
As if on cue, Lark dashes into the cafeteria, followed by Dr. Takumi at a slower pace. Before Lark even makes it to her seat, Naomi, Asher, and I pounce on her with questions, while Katarina and Beckett listen curiously, the two of them still in the dark about Suki.
"Dr. Takumi will explain everything," is all Lark says, but from the look on her face, I have the sinking feeling that it's not good news.
Dr. Takumi strides to his perch at the front of the room and holds up his hands for silence. "I have an unfortunate announcement to make. As you may have noticed, one of our 24 is absent today. Regrettably, Suki Chuan had to be cut early due to her suffering an adverse reaction to the RRB. She is no longer a finalist for the Europa mission."
The news hits me like a blow. I turn to Naomi just as her expression crumbles. Gasps and exclamations of shock ripple through the cafeteria, and my stomach lurches at the realization that Suki is gone. Her chance at a future ruined in one night.
"Where is she?"
Naomi whispers to Lark, her lower lip quivering.
"Still at the medical center. It'll be some time before she's back to her old self, but don't worry," Lark says. "She's getting the best care."
"To anyone concerned this might happen to you, the good news is that the odds of an allergic reaction to the RRB are still very slim. If you haven't experienced symptoms yet, chances are that your body is accepting the serum. However, what happened to Suki is the precise reason we monitor your reactions before you leave Earth."
Dr. Takumi pauses, intensifying his gaze on all of us.
"If you feel anything out of the ordinary, I expect you to come directly to me or to your team leader. The last thing you want is a medical complication to arise on Europa, when you're largely on your own." He clears his throat. "And now, let's try to move beyond this unfortunate circumstance and start today on the right foot."
He gives the signal for us to line up at the buffet counter, but no one at our table moves. Even Beckett looks uncertain.
"Damn. One down already," he says, breaking the silence.
"She didn't deserve this."
Naomi's voice breaks as she turns back to Lark.
"When can we see her? We should at least go visit."
I'm not sure about that," Lark says, glancing away.
"The medical center doesn't allow visitors at this acute stage outside of immediate family. She told me she doesn't have any living family, though, except a stepdad she doesn't get along with,"
Katarina objects.
"Naomi's right. We have to go visit her."
Asher and I nod, and Lark leans forward, lowering her voice.
"I know it's hard, but you need to let this go. Trust me. Nothing good can come from pressing the issue.
You can't do anything for Suki now, but the five of you are still in the running to make the final six. That has to be your focus.